Late Night Live. Ideas and opinions from around the world.
They seek him here, they seek him there, they seek the blighter everywhere. Is he in heaven or is he in hell? That damned elusive Bruce Shapiro. Well, on this occasion, he's sitting opposite me in the studio. Isn't it amazing? It's a Monday. Shouldn't be here at all, but here he is. And in just a minute, we will together conduct an autopsy on the body politic of the United States. Then Bruce is going to stick around for our second story, which involves a fellow called Mark Tushnet, who's a professor of law at Harvard Law School. We've heard a lot about that. Bruce has got a bit of a chest cold. We've heard a lot about Harvard's law school lately. And Mark's coming in to discuss, and he's a fascinating fellow with a great background, the US Supreme Court, the Constitution, and the White House. The third story. Some years ago, I got an email from a young Australian fellow called Julian Assange, who wanted to set up something called WikiLeaks. And he explained the idea that WikiLeaks would blow the whistle on any and every issue available or imaginable using impeccably resourced leaks, hence the name. And he asked me whether I'd be kind enough to become an advisor. Well, I thought that sounded fun, so I signed up. I hasten to add that I've never been asked for advice and have never given him any. But, in fact, I've never even met him. So I'm looking forward to meeting the amazing Julian, the founder and editor of WikiLeaks, a little later in the program. Bruce is now scolding a glass of fine Sydney water. And, Bruce, it's a turbulent time in US politics. You've got three big deal US Senate primaries coming up in the not-too-distant, and each of them is incredibly significant.
Not only not-too-distant, but immediately proximate, tomorrow.
Tomorrow, sir.
We have three major U.S. Senate primaries that show together just how roiling the politics are for both parties, and they sort of span the country. In Kentucky, where we've got an open seat, Republican Jim Bunning is retiring, you have the Republican Party in huge disarray. There's a guy named Trey Grayson, who normally would be a shoe-in. He's got the backing of the Republican establishment, all the major figures in the state, and he carries actually a great family name for anyone who follows Appalachian ballads. Grayson is a name that appears in songs like Tom Dooley. It's one of Doc Watson's family names. Trey Grayson, shoo-in, except he's being challenged by a guy named Rand Paul, who is the son of the Libertarian presidential candidate Ron Paul.
Ron Paul, fascinating fella. And I understand that the son, Rand, is named for a certain notorious American author.
Yeah, for Ayn Rand, the fountainhead of libertarianism in the United States. Rand is running with the backing of the local Tea Party movement as an insurgent from the right, claiming that Trey Grayson and that the rest of the Republican establishment are promoting socialism and are not doing enough to get big government off people's backs. This is a huge, there's a lot on the line for the Republican Party here, because on the one hand, you could say that a victory by a Tea Party candidate shows that the party is pulling together on the right and the Tea Party has all this momentum. But there's tremendous fear that then going for the Republicans, that then going into the fall elections, a victory by a Tea Party candidate will taint the Republican Party with more moderate and unaffiliated voters.
How does a Trey Grayson, Republican, backed by the GOP establishment, how does he fight the Tea Party? What can he say about them which doesn't make his problem worse?
He tries not to address the Tea Party at all, but rather to motivate more moderate Republican voters or traditional Republican voters or even Republican voters who want to win in the fall to turn out. Remember that we don't have mandatory voting in the states. This is a primary, and primaries often have very unpredictable and indeed low turnouts. A difference of a few hundred, a few thousand voters in an off-year primary can make an enormous difference. So what someone like Trey Grayson is trying to do is raise his numbers and hope that the Republic, that the Tea Party folks, while vociferous and loud, actually don't turn out that many people. It's actually...
That seems to be grasping at a straw, I would have thought.
Well, it's grasping at a number of straws. Primaries like this, anti-incumbent insurgent primaries, are notoriously unpredictable, especially during non-presidential years when people are not automatically thinking of themselves as going to the polls. The same thing is happening for the Democrats in Nebraska. We've talked a lot over the past year about a senator, Democratic senator from Nebraska named Blanche Lincoln.
She was the one who opposed climate change legislation and sank her boots into the public option in healthcare.
That's right. She came up repeatedly in the public option and in the healthcare debate generally as the person, along with a guy named Ben Nelson, who as centrist Democrats were holding back progressive healthcare reform. Now, she did finally vote for the bill that made it out of the Senate. So President Obama is campaigning for her. But there is a Democratic lieutenant governor, Bill Halter, who from the left and with the backing of unions is taking a kind of Democratic populist challenge to her.
When you say of the left, what does that mean in the Democrat Party?
Well, these days in the Democratic Party, it's a relative term, but it means... the part of the party that supported public financing for healthcare, that supports very aggressive regulation of banks, very aggressive climate change legislation. So the sort of Roosevelt wing, if you will, or the Teddy Kennedy wing of the Democratic Party, and in particular in Nebraska, the union wing, the labor union wing. That part of the party, which is well organized and hopes it can have significant turnout, is challenging, you know, again, an incumbent Democrat who should normally have a very easy reelection prospect. Again, not clear what the outcome will be. If Lincoln wins, she can say that centrism has survived. That the
I love the name Blanche Lincoln. Touch of Tennessee Williams.
Well,
the Civil War.
Well, also remember that this is the particular part of the Democratic Party that Bill Clinton was once associated with. And of course, we're talking, like, you know, the part of the country, Arkansas, Nebraska, these where traditionally in the last generation, centrism, Democratic centrism had a real foothold, a sense of wanting to appeal to social conservatives, even as you're embracing some kind of economic populism. Well, Blanche Lincoln may have lost that battle. We'll find out this week.
Now, let's go to Pennsylvania. Arlen Specter left the Republican Party in a hissy fit.
Indeed. Arlen Specter, and we talked about this last year, who'd been a from the more moderate tradition of the Republican Party, had been a defender of civil rights and civil liberties overall through his career, much to the dismay of the Reagan right, finally was challenged on the right, looked like he was going to lose his primary. And so he bailed on the Republican Party, joined the Democrats, backed President Obama's economic stimulus. He now, at age 80, is being challenged by Congressman Joe Sestak, who's a little bit younger, who is, it's not exactly a right versus left thing in that case. It's much more a bid by a younger generation of Democratic leader to look at a candidate who seems not deeply rooted in the Republic, in the Democratic Party, although he does have a lot of union backing, and saying this guy has flip-flopped on his party affiliation, he's flip-flopped on issues, he's an opportunist. Vote for someone who's not an opportunist.
Your system lacks an opposition leader. In fact, whoever lost the last election is chucked out the door without much ceremony. So the Democrats, theoretically, are all led by that bloke in the White House. But at a time like this, the Republicans can't field a village explainer.
Well, they can't field a village explainer in part because they are such a profoundly fractured and divided party, and have been for a long time. You know, we talk about the Republicans as if they are one thing. We talk about the American right as if it's one thing.
And the Democrats as if they were one thing, and that's also often fallacious. Right.
But for the Republicans in particular, there have for a long time been several streams. There is the corporate right, which essentially stands for the deregulation of industry and deregulation of Wall Street money. That's one kind of right. There's a religious right, which has its own motivations, its own values, comes out on issues like abortion and gay rights. And then there's a social values right that's much more about appealing to national security fears, to anxiety of various sorts. They don't necessarily play well together. And then into this already squirrely mob strides the Tea Party movement, which is elevating generalized resentment.
Now, theoretically, that sort of disunity would consolidate the Democrats and mean that the midterms shouldn't be so challenging, but that doesn't necessarily follow.
Well, the Democrats, of course, do have plenty of their own divisions. There is the vestigial Bill Clinton Democratic National Leadership Council right wing of the Democratic Party, which is through people like Blanche Lincoln and Ben Nelson, still very much wants a hold in American politics and is trying to figure out what this new world holds. There are
progressives. Your politics is so much more fun than ours. We think ours is a mess, but this is glorious and terrifying.
And then you have progressives who opposed the war in Iraq by and large and have struggled with President Obama on that issue and who in many cases have been disappointed by the final versions of Obama's healthcare bill, the economic stimulus, and so on. So there are a lot of arguments, a lot of family arguments going on within the Democrats right now, and that's playing out in these primaries that we're seeing.
Now, because you are physically here, and this is a rare occurrence, and because the nature of our next guest, I'd like you to stick around, and you might like to interrupt my conversation with Mark Tushnet from time to time. Late Night Live on ABC Radio National, etc. All our global platforms. Little bit of music, please. You will, dear listener, recall that just last week I was chatting with Bruce about the nomination of Elena Kagan to the Supreme Court. She'd never been a judge before. Her strength is her great ability to form a consensus. And we made the view, or expressed the view, that that's probably helpful for the Supreme Court at the moment. He also mentioned that Elena was a clerk for Justice Thurgood Marshall, who was the first African-American to serve on the Supreme Court, and someone I've always viewed through tear-filled eyes. I thought he was a fascinating and remarkable fellow. Well, by coincidence, sitting opposite me is, yes, Mark Tushnet, who also served as a law clerk to Justice Marshall and indeed has written a two-volume work on the life of the justice. Mark's own credentials are noteworthy. He's a William Nelson Cromwell Professor of Law at Harvard School. I always ask guests who have a named chair, Mark, to explain the origin or the name. William Nelson Cromwell?
He was a prominent New York lawyer who endowed chairs in several universities.
Are you proud to carry his banner? Was he a good bloke?
Well, he actually was not a very good person. the chair has been occupied by a number of very distinguished people, and I
would he be turning in his grave at the thought of you?
Actually, probably yes.
Well, isn't that lovely? I'm delighted. Now, Mark's the author of countless books, including the most widely used casebook on constitutional law, and he specializes in constitutional law and theory. And the list goes on, but before we spend the next 20 minutes discussing his CV, let me belatedly welcome him to the Little Wireless program. And Bruce, you're going to stick around as we've already negotiated. Mark, what brings you here?
I'm attending a conference that's sponsored by the U.S. Studies Center at the University of Sydney.
They're not a bad outfit. They bring some interesting people into my studio.
Well, that's good. That's good. I'm happy to be here. This is a very interesting conference on, as I think about it, developments in constitutional review in courts around the world. There's going to be papers on what's happening in the U.S. and in Australia and New Zealand and Great Britain and Canada, I believe.
I want to briefly ask you about Elena Kagan because you knew her, know her quite well. She's dean at Harvard Law School, where you're a professor. A little portrait, please.
Well, she was dean. She's now on leave at the very least and almost certainly not coming back. But she was, first of all, I have to say that she was dean when I was hired, and I have to believe that she played a significant role in that, so I'm not going to say anything bad about her. I could say it demonstrated very good judgment on her part, but there's a certain self-serving character to that.
I like the cut of her jib. I don't want you to demolish her. I'm just.
She was a really terrific dean at Harvard. The school had been experiencing a certain amount of difficulty, both with its faculty and with student unhappiness, and she came in and figured out how to deal with both of those issues in an extremely effective way. You mentioned earlier that she was something of a consensus builder, and she was able to show people who had been fighting each other for a while that there was a path forward that they could all agree on.
You're in a country which is much more agnostic than your own, and religion just doesn't have the same sort of energy here as it has in the US. Thank heavens. You know, we can have atheists as prime ministers without anyone raising an eyebrow. But I'm interested in your comment that religious orientation should be discussed publicly when it comes to the Supreme Court.
I think it's a very peculiar fact that if Elena Kagan is confirmed to be on the Supreme Court, it will be a court that has no Protestants on it in a nation where Protestants are a majority. A
couple of Jews and
there will be three.
Six Catholics and three Jews.
Yeah.
That does not reflect the demographics of the United States.
No. It's just, I don't know that it's, anything to be particularly concerned about, but it's very strange that development has occurred.
One of the reasons that William Nelson Cromwell is revolving in his grave as we speak is because he thought the best candidate would be an openly gay Protestant. Now, we've had an openly gay High Court judge. In fact, he's on the program later this week, Michael Kirby. Would a gay Supreme Court judge be a bit much for the US?
I actually don't think so. When I made that comment, it was a comment about what I thought would be actually politically effective for President Obama. There's quite a bit of, I think, latent pro-gay sentiment in the country.
Really?
Which about doesn't time. Get tapped. Which actually does, nobody taps it. And I think nominating somebody who was openly gay would be a way of doing that.
Well, I have to put this to you, Bruce. We're being told in no uncertain manner by the Murdoch press and others that Kagan is gay. Or at least nudge, nudge, wink, wink.
Well, you know, she's an unattached woman of a certain age, and she's a person who guards her private life. And it's up to her to say whether she's straight, gay, or otherwise engaged. It is interesting, though, that that identity politics now are such a regular part of our political conversation. A decade ago, it would have been immensely controversial just to say what Mark had said, just to make that suggestion, or just even to make the suggestion that Murdoch had made. I think the idea that experience, that biographical experience is somehow relevant to the law, which a few years ago was a profoundly challenging notion, is now widely accepted. And that, I think, is the important piece of this discussion.
Mark Thurgood Marshall was a great activist on your court. What's the situation today with dissenting voices?
Well, there's certainly nobody articulating on the court anything close to the vision of a sort of progressive, democratic, capital D, idea of the Constitution that there was when Marshall or William Brennan were on the court. It's a part of the Democratic Party that is no longer represented on the court, maybe not significant within the Democratic Party anymore anyway. But it's not quite that there's no dissent. It's that the vision of the dissent is more legalistic, less visionary about what the possibilities of an expansive government might be.
Mark, your research includes, and I quote, examining skeptically the practice of judicial review in the United States and around the world. End of quote. Why the emphasis on skeptically?
This is part of the theme in the conference that I'm here for. In the United States, we're experienced with what I've called strong form judicial review, in which the courts step in and say, here are some things you absolutely can't do no matter what. Our theory of judicial review makes that, creates a tension between adhering to constitutional values and democracy or democratic self-governance. And the skepticism is that you could design a system of constitutional review that would not have this very strong effect, which would allow the courts to have some say in the process, but wouldn't give them the last word. What's happening in places around the world, New Zealand, Canada, and Great Britain most notably, is the development of some of these, what I call, weaker forms of judicial review.
And here, have you made observations on Australia?
To the extent that I know what's going on, I think there are sort of, as I understand it, experiments in this sort of institutional innovation. But the vision of judicial review as necessarily like the one we have in the U.S. still seems pretty strong. And my understanding is that that's been an obstacle to the adoption of some form of enforceable Bill of Rights.
Mark, how do you sort of reconcile that with the traditional liberal notion, particularly in the U.S., that minority rights could not be properly defended or extended without strong judicial review, that you would never have had Brown versus Board of Education, right? You wouldn't have had Roe versus Wade?
Yeah, part of the argument is that in many systems and with respect to many issues, the political process, politicians actually are sensitive to rights kinds of issues. That doesn't mean they will resolve them in the same way that judges would resolve them. But then the second part of the argument comes in, which is that in many areas, it's actually quite reasonable to think that there are different ways of enforcing or figuring out what the right actually is. So we've had this recent discussion in the U.S. about Miranda warnings in terrorism cases.
Yeah.
It's not clear exactly what you need to do in that kind of situation. And if Congress says, well, we would like to have somewhat delayed warnings, that might be an acceptable solution, even if the courts would say, you can't do that.
There's a WikiLeak I've just received, and that is that Julian Assange, the founder of WikiLeaks, will be bursting through the door pretty shortly. So, Mark, I want to ask you about our little country. I know you know our constitution off by heart, and you know that its preamble and its text is a bit vague on rights. Many of us have always felt for many years that a Bill of Rights might be a nice idea for the Antipodes, and it's very controversial. Do you think Australia would benefit from a Bill of Rights?
It's for an outsider to say.
You're not an outsider anymore. You're a member of the family.
What I can say is that in the late 20th century and now into the 21st century, virtually everybody who thinks about constitutionalism thinks that some sort of specified Bill of Rights is a good thing to have. Every constitution that's been created since 1945 has a Bill of Rights.
Is that right? Every constitution?
Yeah,
every personal constitution?
The contents vary, but the idea is essentially universal. Where the controversy lies is not, I think, the real controversy is not about having a Bill of Rights, although I understand that here that is what the controversy is. But I think the real controversy is how are you going to enforce the Bill of Rights? And that's where this conversation about whether you have a strong form system or a weak form system really needs to take place.
You're now got almost Australian citizenship, dual citizenship. I think, believe you travel in two passports, unlike Julian Assange, who's lost his entirely. Have you come to a conclusion about a Bill of Rights for Australia, Bruce?
Oh, I think a Bill of Rights is almost always a good idea. I would hesitate to tell my Australian colleagues and friends what to do, but I think specifying the key values that underlie a society and defining the rights of citizens, particularly for those moments of crisis when it's easy to forget them, is pretty important to a functioning democracy.
Mark, how do you feel about your country at the moment? We sit here and it looks so turbulent and seems to be teetering on the edge of some sort of modern, recent version, variant on anarchy.
I don't think it's quite that bad. I do think from the perspective of a constitutional lawyer, I think we are in a very interesting constitutional moment where there's, I think of it as a very strong analogy to what happened in the 1930s, with a president who had an ambitious transformative agenda. There are people who disagree with that about Obama, but I think he has an ambitious agenda. Confronting a Supreme Court that's got a vision, defensible vision, but developed in an earlier time. And the prospect of there being a real confrontation between the administration and the Supreme Court is a real one. It might not happen for a variety of reasons.
But it's started already, hasn't it, with the decision to let the corporations spend as much dosh as they like.
There's certainly something of sort of glimmers of these things on the horizon. The very fact that an argument against our health care reform that would have been frivolous 2 years ago actually has some traction now is another glimmer.
We're going to wind it up. Mark, great to meet you. I hope we can talk again while you're here. Mark Tushnet, Professor of Law at Harvard University in Australia, a courtesy of the US Study Centre at the University of Sydney. Good on you, Study Centre. You've done it again. Details of his talk are on our website. Thank you, Bruce Shapiro, columnist with The Nation and Exec Director of the Dart Centre for Journalism at Columbia University, abc.net.au/rn. Now, the next part of the program is not for everyone. In fact, unless you're okay with ASIO, I'd like you to turn the program off now, because we're going to discuss WikiLeaks. Music, please. Julian Assange is the founder of the website WikiLeaks, which has become legendary, notorious for several exposés, amongst them a recent secret video of Iraqi citizens and a Reuters photographer being gunned down by an American attack helicopter. We discussed it on the program a few weeks ago now. When the video was released, it caused, as it should, an international uproar, big embarrassment for the Pentagon, quite a scoop. Now, tonight, Julian joins us from our Melbourne studio to talk about the impact he and WikiLeaks are having, and I welcome him to our little wireless program. Julian, first up, is there a saga in the fact that you don't currently possess a passport?
I'm not sure. It looks like it was cancelled and uncancelled. This statement to The Age yesterday was that the passport was of normal status, so it appears that I can use it. I assume the DFAT is telling the truth about that. I don't know what's going on behind the scenes. My guess is, having looked at similar experiences, some minor bureaucrat perhaps cancelled it, or there was some flag on a database, and someone with some brains got hold of it and decided that that wasn't a good thing to do and stopped it.
Oh dear. Julian, one of your goals in setting up WikiLeaks was to cut out the middleman, effectively, to take the information straight to the people. And the video footage I mentioned earlier was, of course, the most spectacular example thus far. You must have been quietly proud to see the uproar it caused.
I was proud of our source, foremost, and the team that we sent to Baghdad. I think that was a really heroic bit of journalism to get in there in 2 days and get all the the background story and go to a difficult part of that city and why the election was on.
Has your source remained anonymous? Is he safe?
He or she is remains anonymous as far as we can tell. And in fact, that is true for all our sources. We have never lost a single one of them.
Okay, let's outline for the listeners how WikiLeaks works. An online postbox where people can send documents and information. There's a web address and people email information to you. What happens then? What's the process of deciding what's real and valid and what isn't?
Yeah, so we thought initially that this would be the hard bit, dealing with the fakes. But in fact, all organizations rest upon a gargantuan pile of paperwork, and the economic cost in producing that material comes for free. So the fakes will always be a very small part of the total pile of internal information that is generated. So we don't deal with that many of them. But of course, we have to check every document to see that it's not a fake. But we've had less than 10 interesting fakes. I mean, there's ones that are done by, you know, high school students, or we had one from some guy saying that he discovered that he was the Antichrist when talking to his wife over a pot plant at a cocktail party 10 years ago.
I get a lot of those, yeah.
Well, but this one was genuine. I mean, the guy really believed it.
Right.
But so this process is, you know, you look at the sort of economic cost of producing a document, what is the motivation, and some sort of forensics to do with the electronic format. And then in the end, you just call the people up and say, the organization is meant to have authored it, and say, did you do it or not? And we always get no, yes or maybe. We've only had no once. We get maybe a lot from intelligence organizations. They refuse to admit it. And most other organizations say yes, but. Yes, but it's not what you think. So it's the maybe cases are the more interesting, where they won't confirm or deny. But then you just go down to the facts of the document.
Am I correct in remembering that it was you that released Sarah Palin's prima donnaish lists of demands whilst on tour?
Yes, we released that information, although it was released elsewhere as well, and that appears to be how they managed to get at the source, who allegedly is the son of a Democratic legislator.
I think you and I have got sort of hero in common in Daniel Ellsberg. I had him on the program last year, chatting about his release, his motivations in releasing the US Defense Department's history of the Vietnam War way back in 1969. Was he an ingredient in your mind when you sat WikiLeaks up?
He was not only an ingredient. I spoke to him, and early on he gave a congratulatory message, and I'm speaking with him in New York side by side on June 3rd.
Oh, we'll give him our best. Well, they were inspirational. It was a textbook case of how not to leak, though, wasn't it?
Dan's case was interesting. I mean, he was trying to get that material out for 2 years before he ended up shipping it to the Times. And that extensive delay did affect the political saliency of the material. I mean, he got lucky in by revealing that material having Nixon's plumbers break into his psychiatrist's office and sort of set up a cascade that ended up in Watergate, which is kind of something interesting that when you start exposing an abuse and there's a pushback on you, that sometimes you can get a lot more out as a result of the pushback. As a result of the legal attacks on you, you can reveal other information or you can draw attention to the organisation that's trying to cover something up.
Well, in your case, there's never a two-year wait, is there? It's pretty much on the run. You've broken some very big stories. You've leaked documents from Guantanamo, which showed US policy in action, documents from the financial crisis in Iceland showing that the director of a major bank gave cheap loans to his mates, documents showing illegal dumping of toxic waste on the Ivory Coast. There's clearly a political agenda in all of this.
Not really. I mean, our editorial policy is made clear, and I can tell you it because it's so small and concise, which is we will accept censored material or legally suppressed material or injuncted material that is of diplomatic, political, ethical, or historical significance. And if it falls into that category, we will publish it. And that's it.
But you wouldn't hesitate to embarrass a hypothetical Labor government in Australia if that sort of documentation became available.
Not at all. And we were responsible for the ClimateGate emails. Although it appears that our sort of right-wing sympathisers in the United States have forgotten all that after the Iraq war massacre video. But, you know, we have most of the material, I mean, in exposing abuses and sort of being rational evidence-based is more supportive of rational left-wing ideals. But there are significant cases where we see it, you know, exposing more left-wing governments or left-wing activities.
Not that's not a country mile away from the founding assumption of amnesty either, is it? That, you know, wherever it falls, so be it.
Yeah, and I quite like that. I mean, we dealt with a case, Nahdimi Auchi, who a few years ago was the fifth richest man in the UK, and he had been suing papers all over the UK, and the political editor of the New Statesman, Martin Bright, and was involved in financing Tony Rezko, who was the fundraiser for Obama and had been involved in buying Obama's house. And Nahdimi Auchi ripped out a number of papers from the Guardian's archives, from the archives of London Independent, which was not revealed. And then went after the New Statesman, ended up costing Martin Bright his job, ended up going after us because we managed to get hold of those articles that have been sort of ripped out of the historical record and republished them. But he also went after right-wing papers or blogs in the Hawaii and the US who were interested in this connection between Tony Rezko and Obama. So we formed this very interesting alliance of us, New Statesmen, Hawaii Free Press, AIM, which is like the right-wing version of fairness and accuracy in reporting in the US. So I really enjoy to build these alliances of people that are interested in the truth at the moment, even though at other moments they may be political adversaries.
I want to put something in parenthesis here. I happened to glimpse you on the Colbert Report, and I was fascinated to see how discomforted, uneasy, and even angry he became, he sort of got out of character a bit, didn't he?
I'm not sure. I don't watch Colbert that much, which was probably a mistake. I had seen him at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, and I thought this man had balls of steel, which may well be true. I have been told by others that he is, a big supporter of the troops, and not just in character, but also out of character.
Well, I think that showed. Anyway, let's not dwell on it, but it was the first time I've ever seen him lose his cool with a guest. It's usually layers of irony, you know. And
I'm not sure he lost his cool. I think it was a hard interview for both of us, in that this was a freshly uncovered massacre, and it's a hard thing to joke about, and it really was kind of difficult to make it funny. You know, the ball kept on coming back to the table of something serious, and maybe once it was there, he didn't have much choice but to go for the sort of serious information.
LNL, ABC Radio National, etc., and I'm talking to Julian Assange about WikiLeaks, the whistleblower website he founded. You keep saying we and us, using the royal plural, or is there an us?
There is an us. There is sort of five people who are involved full time, but there's also extensive legal support from time to time. I mean, when we have a battle, we have 800 volunteers that do something in the course of a year, and 10,000 people on our mailing list who are contacts, and then 52,000 people on our Twitter.
Well, that's grown like Topsy, hasn't it, since I got an email from you a few years ago. That's quite a remarkable growth.
And it's a growth that we have a lot of difficulty in dealing with. When you set extremely high standards in that we've never lost a source that we know of, never published a fabricated document without describing it as being fabricated that we know of or that anyone else has alleged. So that's a really very high standard. But now we're drowning in material as a result, I guess, of people's trust in us and the publicity that's come out of some of this stuff.
Julian, you must be under a massive amount of scrutiny from official places. Mysterious organisations must be vetting and monitoring every utterance, private and public.
I'm not sure, but one of our first Twitter followers was the UK Department of Defence, one of our earliest fans. But, we have had surveillance activities against us, and we've had, even back as far back as early 2008, we've had US intelligence reports written on us, some of which we have obtained and released. There's been an ambush in Luxembourg, which didn't end in any violence, but ended in a strong message that it would be in our interest to sit down and have a coffee. And we had in the developing world some more difficulties. I mean, some people who were human rights lawyers who were publicly associated with us and publicly feeding us material were assassinated last March in broad daylight. In the Western world, I don't think we have any sort of physical violence problems. And we've had some threats from Islamics over Fitna, a video by Geert Wilders that we released that was censored as a result of threats of violence. We're in a better position to uncensor that material than its original hosters. But generally, I think we have some surveillance problems, but I don't feel a fear for my physical safety in the West. In some developed countries, a little bit, but there's usually the locals, local guys usually act as a bit of a canary in the coal mine. It's the foreign journalists who cop it last and the local guys who cop it first.
Now, laws regarding libel on the net are still being shaped, and Australia's government looks like it's going to err on the side of caution. You've emphasised that you believe in a truly free press. Does that mean you don't think there should be any laws regulating what's published?
Well, this is about prior restraint, really, and the integrity of the historical record. So there should be laws about restitution. So that is when, so if someone publishes a malicious libel, and if you look in the history of business, this was done quite a lot earlier on. You know, you have a company that makes one kind of soup can, and you've got a competing company, and you say the other company's soup is full of poison. So there has to be some kind of access to justice for libels like that. But that doesn't mean the historic record must be stricken, and that all people and all other publishers who have that information must be subject to coercive force to get rid of it. If there has been, say a libel that has occurred, then it's a part of history that libel has occurred, and it must be able to be kept and talked about by other publishers. But justice should not be denied to the victim, so the victim should still be able to sue for some kind of compensation.
I know you see WikiLeaks not so much as a media outlet, so much as, yes, an historical archive of documents.
That's right. I look at how intellectual history, and I see it split up into three parts. There are those things that are economic, those intellectual records, which are economically sustained by ongoing productive labour. So how to mix concrete, as an example. That's actually something that's quite important. I mean, it sounds like it's nothing, but it's only because it's been around for so long, or how to make pumps. And then there's other parts of the historical archive, our intellectual records, which, while not having an underlying supportive industry, do not have economic incentives to get rid of it. And then there's a third part, which we've never really had much of in our historical archives, which is that information, which is has economic incentives to never enter into the archives, or if it gets in there, to remove it. And I think that's a major hole in our civilization, because how human institutions operate in practice includes all three of those parts of history. And we can't rationally formulate a better civilization unless we know the one that we have.
The little hints of you that I know, or indeed a couple that I remember, characterized you as an ethical hacker. You had a great gift for getting into these archives, these storehouses of information. Has that art peaked, or is the technology and the skills of characters like yourself constantly increasing?
Well, my skills peaked long ago in that field. Yeah, unfortunately, that's a young man's game. But there are others around the world now. I mean, that is constantly changing, and some very good people. But I, you know, not being a quite so young man anymore, the way I like to do it now is, you know, hack people's brains.
I'm sorry, run that past me again.
Well, you can hack people's brains. That is, you can convince them of the morality of a certain act, and then get them to do it.
Does that suggest that you actually do editorial work, that you go out and try and prompt or provoke a story, as well as waiting for them to come in by the goodness of God?
It's a bit of both. I mean, why hack people's brains? I mean, we send out a general message of find information, you know, about military abuses and give it to us. And there's a point to doing that. And it's something worthwhile to do. And look at all these successful examples of other people doing it. Not martyrs, but people that have managed to keep their jobs and at the same time get something off their chest.
But so, that's important, isn't it? People, there are so many ethical people who find themselves trapped in an unethical situation, and they do want to talk.
Yeah, they do, but they don't have access to someone who will listen normally. You know, the mainstream media, and I'm not here to demonize mainstream media for all its faults, because I find the alternative media even worse, it has historically been the output for people who are close to power. I mean, that's who has contact with journalists normally. It's not the secretary, it's not the janitor, it's not the computer engineering consultant. It's not a whole bunch of people in society. It's the people who have power already and have a place to you know, make their interests known. So by providing an outlet for the majority of people, we're seeing a lot more stuff, but we're also seeing material of a different nature. Now, it's not in some particular person's political interest, and that's why it's been leaked. Rather, it's just a result of common moral outrage.
The alternative media is even worse. Talk to that briefly.
Well, you know, when we first started, I thought what would happen, because we were a new kid on the block, is that, well, it'd be, you know, the blogs and the alternative media people who would pick up our stuff, and then the mid-tier media would start picking up the better part of that writing, and it would propagate up to The Guardian, New York Times, and, you know, Le Monde, and El País, and so on, and the Newswires. But it was actually just the opposite. Our material went straight to the top, went straight to New York Times, Guardian, etc., and then came down. And in fact, the alternative media wouldn't touch our material until it had been sanctified by the big players.
Is that right?
Yeah. So I actually look at them as their responsive media. The big media create the market, and then the alternative media simply respond to a market that is already created, but they won't invest. Now, you can say that's because they don't have the resources, but for whatever the reason, they won't invest in doing investigative journalism. They won't invest in, you know, creating original material. So they're born followers. You know, they don't break stories. They don't lead the news. Rather, they follow and respond. And that's actually a bit of a problem with the liberal left in general, is that it's responding to the abuses of the right rather than leading. And that's something that I've seen clearly, you know, over the past 3.5 years that we've been doing this. The alternative media doesn't lead, it follows. When given fresh material that it could actually use to lead, it still doesn't lead, because it's sort of so ingrained that it has to follow leader of the New York Times and respond to it.
Julian, thanks for your time. Julian Assange is the founder of WikiLeaks, and make sure you check this new passport and make sure they haven't put some little secret gizmo in it, so they know where you are before you want them to. This is a wrap for Late Night Live. On our next, Christian Kerr about what's happening in Canberra. Then we're going to talk to David Rothschild, yes, one of those Rothschilds who's sailing across the Pacific on a boat made out of reclaimed plastic soda bottles to sound the environmental alert on what we're doing to our oceans. Don't forget, you can comment on Bruce tonight, on indeed on Julian, on any of our stories. You go to our website, abc.net.au/rn/Late Night Live, and you click on the story and you'll see the comment section. Stick around now for the news on Radio National. And we'll see you later.
Is digital technology having on the classroom?
When every kid has a laptop, it certainly can be an isolating experience. Or you can actually get kids communicating with one another outside their own circle of friends. Because when you don't see the face-to-face, you might be willing to share and ask questions, even ask for help, that you would never ask face-to-face.
That's the digital classroom, future tense, and you can download or stream the program from the Radio National website.